With the introductions made, Council, we're ready to proceed on 99-2389, in re the return of property and state, the Sammy L. Glass, City of Milwaukee versus Glass, George Kirsten representing Sammy Glass. I've got you marked for 15 minutes, Mr. Kirsten. Wesley M. Van Buskirk, representing also Sammy L. Glass, for 10 minutes, 30 minutes by Mr. Stanoch, and then 5 minutes for your rebuttal. Do I have it right? Okay. Please start, Mr. Kirsten.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Your Honors, we would like to share the oral argument as follows. I would like to address the issues directly related to Section 968.20, and Attorney Leslie Van Buskirk would like to address the issues related to the notice and claim issues in the case under Section 893.80, subsection 1. Your Honor, on behalf of Sammy L. Glass, the petitioner here, we believe that this case is controlled by the fact that the legislature placed this issue in the hands of the circuit court. We believe everything else flows from that. The underlying facts of this case were not disputed in the Court of Appeals, and they were found then by the circuit judge, the circuit court, as shown on the ninth page of the appendix, to include the following: that the property in fact belonged to Sammy L. Glass. Secondly, that it was taken by the City of Milwaukee Police as part of a criminal investigation. Third, that the property was transferred to a third party by the city. And fourth, that the fair market value was $1,600. Of course, it's also a given in the case that, as it turns out, Sammy Glass was innocent of the charge for which he was prosecuted, and in connection with which the property was seized from his home.
It's more accurate to say he just wasn't convicted, right?
He was not convicted, Your Honor. The case was dismissed without going to the jury.
Yes. Apparently, there wasn't enough evidence to go to the jury.
Correct. And based on the presumption of innocence and that procedural circumstance, the adjudication was that he was not guilty. And obviously in that circumstance, which can happen in any society that has an effective trial system, from time to time the innocent will be prosecuted. The necessity in a civilized society where one must start out with a presumption of innocence and then prosecute people. We are found here in the following circumstances, however, that the person now found not guilty wants to get his property back. Now, interestingly here, the procedure under the statute is to apply to the court. When there is a finding of fact undisputed at this level that the City of Milwaukee gave it away, the City of Milwaukee didn't have the right to give it to the rightful owner.
Now, when did they give away this property?
Your Honor.
Before or after the acquittal?
I do not know the answer to that, Your Honor. The only thing I do know is that as of the time application was made for Mr. Glass, it was gone.
I have a question on that, and I realize that the city made a, quote, grievous error in the sense they gave it to the wrong party. Would there not be any action against the individual that received the property erroneously? Is there any possibility of, in other words, as I understand the facts, this property was taken from your client. It was then, before the proceeding was completed, it was given to a third party, correct?
That's my understanding, Your Honor, yes.
And there's no possibility of recovery there. Let's say, not just in this case, but it was given, in other words, this was like unjust enrichment, I'm assuming. It said it was given to the wrong party. So I was trying to imagine, well, all of a sudden this person ends up with property that he or she had no interest in, and they were unjustly enriched. I'm talking about where that property ended up.
Your Honor, the city was given the right to implead third parties. I'm aware of anything in the record.
They failed to do so.
That's my understanding, Your Honor, and I'm not aware of anything in the record that would suggest that the city was, in fact, able to start in, at least on a tracing effort. In other words, I don't have any information that I am aware of that would indicate the city knew at the point of this proceeding under 968 whether the city knew the person to whom they gave the property.
That seems so curious to me that they just gave this property to someone, obviously not your client, and then it just drops out of the picture. The property just goes away and not even considered. I was just hoping you had some comment on that, or just what...
Only this, Your Honor, that I would assume Mr. Glass had the same reaction.
Right.
I assume also that your position is that you don't have to go out and find the party. You don't have to go out and sue that person. You might, if you wanted to, but that you can look to the city and just say, hey, you had it last. It's your responsibility. We're after you. I mean, I'm assuming that's your position here.
That would be our position, Your Honor. And the city, as the possessor, I believe, was correctly characterized by the circuit court as being a bailee,
It's like you bring a coat to the cleaners to be cleaned. You come in for it, they're supposed to give it back to you.
Exactly.
They don't. You can get damages from them. You don't have to go find who got your coat.
Yes. We would concede, in fact, would have to concede, that under the statute, the legislature contemplates that the first and preferred remedy is return of the property.
Right.
And that is what is expected under the statute, and presumably most of the time would occur.
Well, now, this is all part of the criminal procedure, right?
It is ancillary.
The guy's acquitted. He says, I want my property back.
Yes, Your Honor. It is ancillary to the criminal proceeding.
Okay.
Although I believe that
this is civil. I'm talking about the recovery part is civil.
But my understanding is that this ancillary proceeding is civil in nature.
Right. But do you have to serve a new summons and complaint and ask the city or state to give you back the property?
Your Honor, that is essentially what the city is arguing.
I know that.
Here's why we feel that should not have to be the case. The legislature has already put the matter in the hands of the circuit court. Just for example, alternatively, the legislature could have enacted a statute that said that upon completion of the criminal proceeding, a person may apply to the public agency holding the property to have it returned. And it could be handled administratively. And if the person, for example, in Sammy Glass's position, couldn't get his property, he could then start a lawsuit. But that is not what the legislature did.
Okay.
The legislature called upon the applicant to apply to the circuit court.
Right.
When it did so, when the legislature enacted that structure, it already had in place the rather broad, in fact, extremely broad statute listing the powers of the circuit court.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the equity powers, the powers of law and equity. And the law was also well established in the state of Wisconsin that if a court is not in a position to act as an equity court normally would, namely return the property in kind. It can, in that same equitable jurisdiction, do complete justice by instead giving a money remedy.
Well, the way this statute reads, it reads like, and this is, I think, part of the state's argument, what we called in the old days when you and I went to law school, Mr. Kirsten, in rem. That is, you apply to the court for the property in the jurisdiction in which the property was last seen, in effect, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the court tells you who to give notice to, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it gives you all the notice, and then if you prove that you have the right of possession, the court can order the property, other than contraband. You can't sue back for drugs, for example, right?
Okay. Yes.
So how can you turn this into a personal jurisdiction to get back the money? That's what you're asking to do, right?
Yes, Your Honor. We are, because the court has the power under this to bring persons in. Any person who has an interest. The city had an interest as a bailee.
Right.
So the court has that power, and that is what occurred here.
And did they all come into this proceeding?
The city argues now that it did not, and we do not feel that is a valid argument, Your Honor. The city argues that the actual prosecuting authority was the state. Sammy Glass contends in this case that the city is a kind of a joint venturer with the state in a prosecution. There's a kind of a mutual agency, and there's really an arm of the state, and this is in the usual, this case is in the very usual context that it will be, for example, the city of Milwaukee police that will do the investigation and the seizure, and there's nothing we know of that was untoward in that respect at all, but the state will be the prosecutor, but they're really working together. Granted, the city is not exactly the same entity. It is an arm of the entity that prosecuted. But the city was given the petition and appeared. And it was not a casual appearance by any means, because there were repeated appearances in the formal legal sense at a number of hearings, and then the final order entered by the court formally records the city's appearance. No challenge was made in the Court of Appeals to that point. Obviously, there's a challenge to jurisdiction over the subject matter. That's clearly what the appeal was about and what this review is about, but not on personal jurisdiction. So the city was in this 968-20 proceeding, and granted there was no summons served on the city, but the statute provides that there is a waiver unless the city has challenged personal jurisdiction in the absence of a summons.
Mr. Kirsten, how did Mr. Glass establish that he owned the property?
Your Honor, I am not clear on that. I did not participate myself in the trial level proceedings, but I do know that the finding of fact by the circuit judge is that the property, one of those four findings of fact was that the, number one, the property identified in the petition was in fact the property owned by the petitioner, Sammy Glass.
Who do you think has the burden of proving ownership?
Your Honor, I would say that the circuit judge's disposition of that issue in the record that I am aware of was accurate, that Sammy Glass, having possession as of the seizure, as of the moment before the seizure, is presumed to be the owner.
Yeah, and the statute doesn't use the term owner, and perhaps I should have just said, if the statute says if the right to possession is proved, the court satisfaction, so it might not be the owner. It doesn't have to be the owner.
That I see that, Your Honor, in the first phrase of the statute. And Sammy Glass, I believe, without question, was the possessor of the property as of the moment before the seizure.
Is there anything in the record that indicated whether Mr. Glass had testified at the criminal trial?
I am unaware of anything in the record to that effect, Your Honor.
Is there anything in this record that indicates that he testified under oath that he owned this property?
Not that I am aware of, Your Honor. I am aware only of the record that was made that there apparently were photographs that described the property or showed the property, and the impression I have from that record is that at least those photographs were accurate, although that was not a testimonial record, Your Honor. So far as I know.
Let's come right to the heart of this. You say that the state sometimes tries innocent people, and that is true. The state also sometimes tries people who did something, and they get away with it. How do we know which is which in this case?
Your Honor, because under a due process of law, Sammy Glass was acquitted.
Well, but it seems to me, as I read the statute, he must establish to the court's satisfaction, and there's got to be some underlying facts here. He must establish ownership of the property.
Or at least the right to possession. And I believe, Your Honor, that fact cannot be disputed by the city at this point. That was found by the circuit court. I do not know what occurred at the final hearing other than what was recorded in the final order. But that was found by the circuit court and not challenged in the Court of Appeals or here in the petition. Okay. So I think that's a given for this court, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Thurston. Ms. Van Busterk? Yes, ma'am.
Okay. May it please the court. I think that on the 89380 issues, which I'm going to address, Judge Schutzen's comment is very applicable here. He said that inflexible application of 89380 to the proceeding under 96820 elevates form over substance and renders an absurd result. I believe that's very true here. The notice requirement under 89380 has the purpose to provide the governmental body with the opportunity to compromise and settle the claims without costly and time-consuming litigation. I feel that applying that statute to the 96820 proceeding, in fact, runs counter to the whole purpose of 89380. In this case, the city's rights were fully protected. They were represented at the hearings. They were given time for investigation. They were given time for discovery. They were given time to implead additional parties if they chose to do so. I didn't find any evidence in the record that they knew who the property had been given to. The application of the notice requirements just, to me, run totally counter to the purpose of 89380 and our waste of precious judicial and other resources.
Counsel, and under 89380, and this is claims against governmental bodies, officers, and employees. I'm always surprised about the claim statute because it seems to be that notice statutes, oftentimes they're different for the subdivisions of the state as contrasted to the requirements for the state itself. And of course, the city is a subdivision of the state. And under 89381A, and as a trial court judge, we would have this with some frequency, people would say, okay, judge, I didn't file the notice of claim, but not to worry, that the other side had actual notice and they weren't prejudiced. So perhaps you could speak to those two items, because failure to give the requisite notice under the statute is not a bar to the action if there is actual notice of the claim and there is no showing of prejudice. So speak to that.
Your Honor, that's absolutely correct. In this situation, the city, unlike in the typical case where you have, let's say, a injured person who slips and falls and they have all the facts, in this situation, it was the city that had all the facts. The city had taken possession of the property, had put it somewhere, had given it to someone. None of that was within Sammy Glass's knowledge. That information was totally within the control of the city. Therefore, they did have actual notice of it. The police department knew they had actual notice of this potential claim if they were to give it away improperly, which they did. Their negligence in doing so injured Sammy Glass in that he was deprived of his property without due process.
When, if the record shows, when did they receive notice that Mr. Glass wanted the property back? And when did they receive notice of a request for money damages in lieu of property?
Well, as to the notice that he wanted his property back, for one thing, they did seize the property from him against his will. He obviously was being arrested, and they took the property from him, so I think that it's safe to assume that they would know he would want it back at some point. He did file a petition for the return of the property at the end of the proceeding. As to the money, I don't think that actually came up until it was determined that they had lost or given away the property. And I think what's crucial here is that all that would be accomplished by Mr. Glass going through an 89380 proceeding is additional litigation and maybe a hearing on the value of the property, because everything else has been covered in the 96820 proceeding. The 96820 proceeding allows them to determine the ownership. It allows them to determine who should get it back. But the only thing that's not provided for is a determination of value. So to require a whole other lawsuit be filed in front of another judge who's unfamiliar with the proceedings in order merely to have a valuation on the property seems a grievous waste of judicial resources.
Did Mr. Glass file a small claims complaint?
Well, I don't know if under 89380, I assume that yes, he could. I don't know why.
If you were to lose this case, what would prevent Mr. Glass from filing a notice on the city and filing a small claims complaint?
Well, I'm not sure if it would be considered timely at this point.
Depending on what's the act or omission here, right?
Excuse me?
Would depend on what the act or omission is under that statute. Is that the wording of 893?
I mean,
there's
so.
A time period here.
Right, it's 120 days from the act or omission, and I'm not sure.
Yeah, so it depends on what the act or omission is. Is the act or omission when they fail to give him the property, when he made request, when this trial ended?
Right, when he realized he wasn't getting it back. I'm not sure what. I mean, it would
your
seem
time may have run if we hold on 89380.
Right.
Why do you think we need to do it when we have a special statute under 980? Haven't we had cases that say, well, if you got a special statute, then that trumps 893.80, which is the general statute?
You're right, Your Honor. That is correct.
What case was that? Since I can't remember any case names, so I don't know why I asked you to. But that was, as I remember it, a condemnation case.
It might have been the Gillen case.
I think that's it. And there was
Gillen
a condemnation case.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So what precisely, what's your argument that we don't, why don't we have to do this?
Well, for one thing, I do believe that there was actual notice and that there was no prejudice to the city, because if he were to file a claim under 89380, he would get the value of the property in any event. This isn't a situation where there's going to be an issue of was this a discretionary duty or not. They had the property. They needed to keep track of it. They didn't have the right to give it away to anybody under the law, as I understand it, that it was up to the court to determine who it should be given to. So they had no discretion whatsoever. So given that, there's really, the fact of the matter is they had the property, they lost it or gave it away, and he's deprived of it, so he would be entitled to its value. The fact that they didn't keep good enough records to implead someone else, I believe, is the city's problem. I don't think that should be Mr. Glass's problem. And if they did keep the records, then they should have impleaded that person, and that could all be fought out at that time. But that's not what happened here. It was lost or given to someone without appropriate records.
Counsel, how does the Gillen case help you? It's my recollection that Gillen went on the approach that there was injunctive relief being sought, and because of that, 893.80 didn't apply. How does that apply in this situation?
I don't really think I don't think that's really what Gillen said, Your Honor. I believe that what the point of Gillen really was that because injunctive relief was sought, that applying 893.80 would defeat the purpose, because it would, by definition, delay exactly the proceedings, so you couldn't have the immediate injunctive relief.
How does that relate to this situation?
Well, 893.80 would apply to, it doesn't category not apply to anything besides money judgments. It's not strictly a money judgment statute. It would apply to any type of relief being sought, declaratory or other, if there weren't a more specific statute at issue. And in this case, as Justice Abrahamson, I think, pointed out, that there is this 96820 proceeding. And because the purpose of 96820 would be defeated by applying 89380 to it, and that actually it also frustrates the purposes of 89380 to apply it to the 96820 proceeding, that it would just be a waste of judicial resources. And
isn't the one problem you've got with all of that reasoning that 96820 does not authorize specifically money damages?
Well, that seems to be the only problem that seems to be very apparent. But it seems to me that the court, in its equitable powers, has the authority to grant such relief, and it certainly is in the interest of judicial resources to do so. The court does have to take reasonable steps to limit litigation, you know, rather than prolong it where it can. And it's certainly in the interest of judicial economy to do so here. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Stanich, Assistant City Attorney, Milwaukee, representing the City of Milwaukee.
May it please the court. When I first received notice that this court had accepted Mr. Glass's petition, candidly, I was pleased. It is a rare honor for me. I've never appeared before this court. I also thought that I'd have an opportunity to view your new courtroom. Instead, I have the opportunity of participating in a small way in the dedication of the Dodge County Justice Facility, and that is also an honor.
Our courtroom isn't ready, counsel. It won't be until September, so maybe you'll get another case by then.
Honestly, Madam Chief Justice, I think I am the first assistant city attorney assigned to the prosecution section of the city attorney's office that has appeared before this court.
You know, and usually the city doesn't appear. The state AG's office appears, so we're delighted to have you, counsel.
Well, thank you. With respect to the case before the court, the city does agree with the basic analysis of the Court of Appeals. We think that this is a case that is one, if not solely, primarily resolved by the statutory interpretation of Section 96820 of the Wisconsin statutes. The city is not disputing the subject matter jurisdiction of the court. The city appeared and is not disputing the fact that it appeared before the trial court. It participated in what it believed to be an in rem proceeding in response to being served by Mr. Glass with a copy of a petition for a return of property. And that is the issue that we confronted when we walked into court and said, here we are, Your Honor. And from day one, and there were four appearances, it was the city's consistent position that we can't return what we don't have, and the only remedy available under this statute is to have the court return the property, to have the city return the property to the person deemed appropriate by the court.
Now, counsel, is that understanding that, does that sound reasonable or fair when property was allegedly taken or was taken by the city and the city misplaced the property, so the person comes in under 96820 to get the property back and the city says, well, we don't have the property, therefore we're not liable?
Yes, and I'd like to speak to that issue at a number of different levels. First of all, there was no filing fee paid. A one-page form that was completed and a rather nominal amount of time spent in court, at which time the court and Mr. Glass were advised the city does not have the property. How much time, effort, and energy was wasted by Mr. Glass? Very little.
Counsel, how about if we take the example, following up on Justice Wilcox's question, setting the statute aside, because I understood his question to be one of equity and fairness. And let's say you're not the city, but you are the dry cleaners that the chief just referred to. And I brought my skirt to you to be cleaned. And I showed up a week later, and you said, oh, we gave it to, I don't know, someone who lives...
Salvation Army.
Or,
I never liked that skirt anymore.
Or, you know, someone who lives on the west part of town or something like that. And I said, well, I bring it to you. I mean, you're holding it. And you said, no. And I know I gave it away. I gave it away by mistake, but too bad. That seems to me to be a little unfair. And I don't see the difference between the dry cleaners and the city's position, based on fairness, taking the statute aside.
Justice Bradley, you are right. You would have a cause of action against that dry cleaner. But the city appeared in something that was not a cause of action. And this is where the city and the Court of Appeals part company, and where I would have the court look at the final two paragraphs of the First District Court of Appeals decision. We don't believe that 89380 applies to this proceeding. Why? Because we weren't involved in a cause of action. There was no summons and complaint here. All that is required under 96820 is that notice be given to persons who have an interest in the property in a manner that the trial court deems to be adequate. There's no responsive pleadings, no opportunity to assert affirmative defenses.
Counsel, you make a good point, and I think you maybe depart from the Court of Appeals more than in just the last paragraph. The Court of Appeals, as I read the slip opinion on page 4, says that this is a criminal, not a civil matter, as I read the opinion. Do you agree with that or disagree?
I agree wholeheartedly, and here is why. If you assert that this is a civil proceeding, you open up the door to having district attorneys taking depositions of people who want their property back, who may be subject to an ongoing criminal investigation.
Didn't you, counsel, ask for civil, didn't you ask for discovery?
That is exactly what I asked for. Why? Because the court was backing the city into a corner where it conceivably could be subject to monetary damages of an unlimited nature, and it was incumbent upon me in that courtroom to be able to verify the extent of what the claim was.
Is civil discovery allowed under 96820, the civil discovery that you asked for?
Civil discovery is allowable under a special proceedings, and the trial court in this matter indicated that 96820, in his opinion, was a special proceeding. This court in State v. Jones, in addition to making reference to the fact that this is an interim proceeding, in determining what the relative burden of proof was, made reference to chapters 801 through 847. I personally feel that that is unfortunate, because I think it opens the door for a clever district attorney to say, well, listen, we've got a criminal suspect here. He wants his property back. We haven't charged him yet. Let's sit down and depose him without his attorney present. Now, we may no longer have a Fourth Amendment in this country, but we still have a Fifth Amendment. And I don't think that the enactment of 96820 was intended to undercut the Fifth Amendment.
Well, counsel, you know realistically that would any, if he's there without counsel, and that's what you seem to be indicating, I don't think the Jones case or the stand for that or any court would stand for a defendant being there without counsel.
But if it's a civil matter and the district attorney's office is always a participant in a petition for return of property, that would be the exact result.
Well, counsel, when I read this case, it occurred to me that it was sort of the reverse of restitution. If the defendant were convicted, then in the criminal case, you can have restitution. And there's no complaint as to how much. There's no answer. I don't know if there's any discovery. And I've been looking because I had in mind that maybe the court even enters a judgment about the amount of restitution, right?
Quite honestly, Your Honor, in as much as I practice in the civil area,
I don't. It's 973.20 on restitution. It's part of the criminal proceeding, part of the sentencing. And the court can order the return of property, can order value, can order payment of amount for medical damages, etc. So what I'm getting at is the court has upheld that. Our court has upheld this proceeding in restitution. So why shouldn't you say the opposite is true? The defendant has to pay restitution to the victim, and rightly so. Why shouldn't the state pay back to the defendant the property the state took or the city took? Now, while you're pondering that, had this been a drug case and had there been a conviction, there are statutes that allow for law enforcement officers to seize a property that's used in these drug cases. So I must tell you, I've ridden in a number of vans that were seized during drugs and convictions. So there you go. And I think, I can't remember if it was city police or sheriff. I think it was the sheriff. But maybe the city law enforcement can get this equipment too. So that goes to the state versus city issues. But what's unfair about this? Restitution on the one hand, city gives restitution on the other when it goofed.
It is wholly, I'm not suggesting that if the city goofed, it should avoid culpability.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue really becomes, what is the proper procedure? We have a specific statute that provides for a specific remedy, nothing more, the return of the property. At that juncture, the case is dismissed.
Don't think it's implicit in that if you can't give back the property, you give money. I mean, that's the usual rule. You get specific performance in the law. But if you can't give it, then you have to get money damages.
The council, what would be, excuse me?
So you just don't accept that? You just, the law stops there, period?
This court in 1910, in a case that I cite in my brief, Brenger versus Brenger, dealt with an interesting situation. Mrs. Brenger was not a particularly nice lady, was divorcing her infirm husband, who was blind, and he needed alimony. And the statute there said only ex-wives are entitled to alimony. This court said when utilizing its equitable powers, a trial court is limited by what the statute authorizes.
Well, he, counsel, counsel, I tend to, and my instincts are to go with your position, that 968.20 is clear and unambiguous on its face, and it refers only to the return of property, not money, and in order for the plaintiffs to get around that apparent clarity and apparent unambiguity, they must show some exception. Now, one of the exceptions to that kind of interpretation is that an interpretation, we would not interpret a statute so as to leave an absurd result. Now, I would like to know, legal questions aside, why is that not an absurd position for the legislature to have taken? What is it about return of property that's okay, but why the legislature may have had a good reason to stop there?
It is clear to me that what the legislature intended to do was to facilitate an expedient return of property, one that was not burdened by the normal process of chapters 801 through 847, and that's why you don't have a summons and complaint, and that's why there's no affirmative defenses, no responsive pleadings.
But what is it about money that's so different from property? I mean, here it's some copper wire as opposed to $1,600. Why shouldn't we interpret it so that the court has equitable power to do that? That's what I'm asking, counsel. Give me a reason, if I'm going to write this opinion for you, why this makes sense.
Because it is a fairly easy process for the city to return property that it has in its possession. It is a fairly dangerous proposition to say that the city should be exposed to claims for monetary damages without the benefit of the notice of claim statute, that it is a fairly dangerous proposition for this court to ignore the distinction between an in rem proceeding and an in personam proceeding. And what the city participated in no doubt, is an in rem proceeding.
Can you ever turn an in rem into in personam? I didn't look it up, and I just don't remember from law school.
I have never seen that done, and quite honestly, if this court were to rule in that fashion, it would be of great benefit to the city. We are involved in a great many in rem proceedings, in rem tax foreclosures, where what is our remedy? We're entitled to foreclose upon real estate. Can we now pursue the owner of that property for the deficiency that property may not cover the back taxes? No, not under those proceedings.
Could I ask you a hypothetical? Suppose we have a criminal case involving a drug defendant. And among the items seized was $1,600 in cash. And the defendant is found not guilty. In fact, let's say it's clearly established that he is an innocent person. And when he applies for things that were seized, including the $1,600, it's discovered that there's $14 there. That's all there is. Where's the rest of my $1,600? What does the city say at that point?
We no longer have the currency, so that the specific currency that was seized cannot be returned. The issue then hinges on whether or not money is a fungible item. And that's not an issue that presents itself in this case, and quite candidly, I don't know the answer to the court's question. But the issue would be resolved by a determination as to whether money is fungible like wheat or corn or pork bellies.
Well, let's take that hypothetical. I mean, and would it be the city's position? Look, I don't know where the money is. I know we had $1,600, and now we only have $14. Someone must have taken it. Although we held it, and by law we're required to hold it, but you, Justice Prosser, you go find out. You find out who took it. It's not our responsibility.
No, I'm not suggesting that under those facts it wouldn't be our responsibility. The question is twofold. Whether or not under 968.20 that money can be treated as fungible and a court can, in essence, award a return of that property because $1,600 is $1,600 is $1,600, or whether money is not fungible, in which case there'd have to be a notice of claim and a small claims lawsuit commenced.
Let me tell you what one of my problems is, and I need your assistance. You emphasize the process, and you emphasize the statute 968.20, and you say the plain words of the statute allow for a certain process, and that process does not include money damages. That's what I understand your argument to be. And in your oral argument, you say the defendant is limited by what the statute authorizes. I say, okay. My question is this. If the defendant is to be limited to what the statute authorizes, then why isn't the city limited to what the statute authorizes? Why is it okay for the city to ask for civil discovery? Why is it okay for the city to ask the court for permission to do interrogatories and other inquiries? That's not authorized by the statute. Why isn't what's good for the goose is good for the gander?
You're absolutely right. We should not have been. The inquiry should have ended as to when we could or could not return the property.
But you asked for that, and then you got an extension, another 30 days and another 30 days.
Yes. And clearly the city wanted to be in a position to determine the nature of the value of the property that it could not return. And if you read the third appearance, where I appeared, I believe, on December 4th. After the discovery issue is resolved, I make an oblique reference to a document that Mr. Glass provided to the city. It was that document that verified that the value of what we were litigating was $1,600. Up until that point in time, I had no way of knowing whether it was $1,600 or $16 million. And certainly it would...
Well, you knew, counsel. Now, wait a minute. You had your own photographer took the picture. And as I recall in looking at part of the record, that the defendant had 19 of these pictures showing, because at first it was said you took the pictures, and then it was established later on that either the police photographer at the behest of the prosecution that these pictures were taken. So you did have, what you didn't know was how much it was worth per pound or whatever.
As I stood in that courtroom.
Let me just also say you had the criminal complaint, which said the value, and this was more than that one, was between $1,000 and $2,500. And I'm now looking to see if they gave a value for the copper wiring. The value was $600 under the complaint.
You're assuming facts not in evidence. The city was not provided with a copy of the underlying criminal complaint.
It's a public record, isn't it, counsel? Could you take judicial notice of it?
I didn't have that information when I walked into that courtroom.
Okay.
Kurt Belling.
Mr. Belling.
He's assistant city attorney?
Yes.
And you're talking about this statement, that there is a statement he's provided. This is on page 22 of the appendix. It says, I don't know if he shared this with you from Spring City Recycling, showing the poundage or number one. That's apparently how you established that. And you also knew from the pictures, which you had in the record. I mean, that's in, I found out about the pictures by reading the record.
Once again, yes, those pictures were in the possession of Mr. Glass and shared with me during the course of that third hearing. I did not have...
Who took the pictures?
A detective with the Milwaukee Police Department.
Before Mr. Glass got possession of those pictures, I mean, I'm just going by what would seem to be logical, who had possession? The prosecution.
The state may have. I had no possession of any photos.
Why don't you, counsel, describe what exactly is in one of these return of property petitions? It's a one-page document. It's very perfunctory. It bears the criminal case number, identifies the person who is seeking return of the property, and it's not always the defendant. Very often it's some third party whose property has been seized pursuant to a search warrant or a warrantless search, and it identifies the property sought by inventory number on the police report. Is that about it?
That is all the information that the city has provided. We are not given a copy of the underlying criminal complaint. We walk into that courtroom blind.
And it says, come to court on this day with information about whether you're prepared to return the property or not.
That is correct.
You still have it on inventory, and whether you're prepared to return it. And in the usual case, these are only contested in the case of a firearm.
Thank you for sharing your personal knowledge and past career experience with the court. Yes, it is.
Is that a leading question?
It is a rather perfunctory document that is limited in its nature, but I think it's consistent with the intent of the statute, and that is to facilitate a quick return of property with a minimal amount of due process and complication. And the city has always participated in these hearings with that goal in mind.
And had you checked the file, you would have found that if I'm reading it right, the circuit court here dismissed during a jury trial, didn't let it go to the jury, and dismissed this case because the state hadn't proved enough to even get to the jury, if I'm reading this right. Do you agree with that?
That is my understanding,
okay.
Yes.
And then it took 6 months before the defendant here petitioned pro se for return of the property, right?
Yes.
And then there were, maybe nine or ten proceedings of one sort or other before an order was entered about a year later.
My understanding is that there were four hearings involving the city.
Right, and various other proceedings of one sort or other, filing papers, et cetera, and reviews and transcripts before this was settled. Do you think that they can file for a claim against the state, or is that time run out? I don't mean against the state. I apologize to you, against the city.
I have not researched the issue of whether during the pendency of Mr. Glass's petition to this court, whether the time within which to file a notice of claim with the city is told. It is an interesting issue, one that, again, I didn't prepare. Presuming that the statute of limitations is told, certainly he would then be in a position to file a notice of claim, and if that claim were denied, then to commence a lawsuit.
What about subsection A that says within 100 days after the happening of the event giving rise to the claim? What's the event here? Is it the seizure of the property, failure to return the property, finding of not guilty?
I'm not sure.
No, it's another problem, isn't it?
Justice Bradley?
I think it was a follow-up. The notice of claim provides for within 120 days of the event. Is it your position, if there is no statute that allows for tolling, that the 120 days has passed and he would be time-barred from bringing any civil action, whether it be for unjust enrichment or whatever the cause of action against the city? I may have inferred from your argument in your briefs, it was my impression that that seemed to be where you were going, that he potentially might be time-barred under
893-80
in any subsequent action, not just this action, because of failing to file a notice within 120 days.
I was not inferring that.
Okay.
I don't know whether he has that capacity of resurrecting that notice of claim.
May or may not. I mean, it could be. If he doesn't, and he's barred by notice of claim defense, if it would go to a subsequent action, then he's out, right?
I will answer that with some detail. You recently dealt with one of my coworkers on a case involving Oliveira versus the City of Milwaukee. And in his brief, he cites to Robbie versus Outagamie County at 72 West 2nd, 492. And this addresses...
What is that, a 1976 case?
1975 case.
Okay.
It is certainly possible that 893-81A can be waived by a municipality. But I think if you apply the logic of Robbie, and that's a case dealing with a county in a different statutory section, but if you apply that to the City of Milwaukee, it may very well be, and I think the law in the state of Wisconsin is, that the provisions of 893-81B cannot be waived.
And which one are we dealing with here, 1A or 1B?
Both. Mm-hmm. Basically, 1A is what I will refer to as a notice of injury.
Right.
1B is your notice of claim. And 1B requires that there be a denial of that claim. And if it's not within 120 days, then the claim is deemed to be denied.
Don't you think it's likely that the 968-20 proceeding would be deemed to have conferred actual notice on the city for purposes of any subsequent civil lawsuit and the exception to the notice of claim in instances of actual notice? And so Mr. Glass is not out of luck on that basis. I mean, there is an exception
certainly
in cases of actual notice.
Well, the city knew that Mr. Glass was seeking a return of his property. I was dismayed when I walked into the trial court and it was clear that the city was being exposed to a claim for money damages without there being any pleadings based solely upon the trial court's enunciation that, oh, this is a bailment. Well, there's no bailment pled. Not that any is required by Mr. Glass to pursue his petition for return of property. But we had no other pleadings. And I was certainly surprised as to how this was being marshaled forward. And it's why, again, I asked, almost insisted upon the penumbra of protection with respect to discovery so that I could determine what the scope of the claim was against the City of Milwaukee.
Now, how do you think this should have been handled? You don't question that Mr. Glass had the right to make an application, right?
None whatsoever.
Okay. And in the way he did it.
Okay. And I think that was wholly appropriate.
Okay, so then the city looks around. It doesn't have the property. It hunts high and low. It covers every nook and cranny in all of its multiple buildings and says, no can find a ton of whatever we're looking for. And so the city comes into court and says, Your Honor, we don't have this property. We did have, but we don't have. Now, is it your position that at that moment, and we're not going to question the honesty or integrity of the statement, we all accept it, including the defendant. Is it your position that the court should have dismissed the application immediately?
Precisely, yes.
And then the defendant is just left to whatever means, make a claim, not make a claim, small claims action, whether I have a claim, and then the city will just fight about the who has the right to possession and money, right?
That is exactly the city's position, yes.
But in this case, you or somebody forced Mr. Glass to show a right of possession, right? That there was an inventory, that the inventory had this what are we talking about, the copper wire?
The form that is used in Milwaukee mm-hmm. County has a blank for the inventory number, mm-hmm. and this allows the city to readily identify right. the REM that we are dealing with.
Right. And he gave the wrong number initially,
yes,
and then he got the right number. So once he did that and you couldn't find it, that should have ended it. That's your position.
Yes.
In a nutshell.
Precisely. And I think that avoids any conflict between what is required under 89380 and the procedures under 96820. I do not think that this is the kind of case that the court dealt with in the city of Neenah. I don't think that there is the requirement that an exception be carved out, an additional exception to the provisions of 89380, because we're not dealing with an action. And 89380, I can't emphasize this enough, deals with only causes of action. So there's no conflict unless you go
we're
down the road.
Losing action and not to include proceeding, right?
Yes.
And I wonder if somewhere in the statutes it doesn't say action includes proceeding, but we won't debate that now. You can see no notice is needed under the 900 statute.
Under 96820, yes. I think it is inconsistent with the intent of the legislature to facilitate the return of property.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Kirsten, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, some of the court's questions went to the issue of the legislature stopping there, I believe was one of the phrases that was used in the questioning, and part of the difficulty being that the legislature did not provide for an alternative remedy of damages. And we would invite the court's attention to the rule we would urge be followed. In that circumstance, as we understand it, the rule this court follows is the legislature is presumed to leave all the powers with the court unless they are expressly taken away. So that under that rule, even though the legislature did not expressly grant this power, the presumption that this court gives to the legislative act is that the court, in putting the matter in the hands of the circuit court, intended to allow the court to have all of a circuit court's powers. Now, what does an equity court do when it grants damages? By definition, that is a substitution. I don't believe that an equitable award of damages is a damage award in the common law sense. It is an equity court's attempt to do the next best thing. It is a substitution by definition. And that is why that equitable rule should apply here.
However, the court still must have jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction, over the person of the party being ordered to pay the money damages. Isn't that true?
The court must have personal jurisdiction over the person ordered to perform an equitable remedy, which in this case would be payment of money. Yes, Your Honor.
And the city was not a party to the criminal action. Nor was the city a party to the 96820 action.
Your Honor, the city, as to the criminal action, the city, in a sense, is in privity with the prosecution.
Is there any support for that notion in the law?
We believe, yes, Your Honor, under cases such as State versus Martinez.
What does that case say?
That the
I believe in that case it was that the city was the arm of the prosecutorial authority one way or another, but I believe it's...
For what purpose?
Pardon me?
For what purpose?
For purposes
what was the
of
issue?
The prosecution, Your Honor. In other words, the investigative body frequently is, as I understand it, a different entity from the prosecuting
body. What was
body.
The legal issue in that case, though?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that I could...
It certainly wasn't a case involving the city being ordered to pay money damages
no,
for property
was
that was lost
no.
after seizure upon a search warrant.
It was not, Your
okay.
Honor.
So it doesn't stand for the proposition that the city or any investigating agency independent of the state of Wisconsin is a party to the criminal prosecution.
Your Honor, that does not stand for the proposition that the city was a party to the criminal prosecution.
The city is not even a party to the 968-20 procedure. It's a party entitled to notice.
But we believe, Your Honor, it is a party because because it is a formal legal proceeding pursuant to a statute, the purpose of which is to vindicate a right, and the city is brought into that, and as the possessor of the party, possessor of the property, the city is in a sense a target of the statute.
Well, the city is whichever investigating agency, whether it's the city or the county, whoever holds the property that's been seized is brought into the action, but only by virtue of the in rem nature of this procedure and proceeding. The court's jurisdiction is over the property, you know, separate and apart from the criminal jurisdiction in the case. The court's jurisdiction under 968-20 is over the property for purposes of ordering its return. It's not over the city as a party to the action.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not... I do believe that where in an in rem proceeding it is directed to the possessor of the property, I believe the possessor of the property is a party to the proceeding. I don't believe the fact that it is an in rem proceeding excludes the fact that the persons, including the possessor that is before the court with the property, is not a party.
Well, Mr. Kirsten, it seems as if that's the issue of the case, and if I could...
One question.
Well, let's make it very fast, because at 10:45 we're due for the dedication.
Would this be the same if the property was injured, in other words, in the possessor's property? In other words, they returned this, but it was injured in some way. Would you still be making that the court has an equitable remedy to award not only the property, but money? In other words, there's injury to the property. It was worth $1,000 when they took it, and they did something to it.
Offhand, I would say yes, Your Honor. And I think because what we are really dealing with here is putting the matter in court with a judge who starts the proceeding with essentially knowledge of all of the players, so to speak, already has all of those advantages. And the legislature has said, let the circuit court that had the criminal proceeding and knows what has gone on, let that court handle this. We think that's the underlying intent of this statute.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Kirsten. Thank you.